Well, this is the time for those of you who have any things you'd like to ask about. Please don't be shy. My experience so far in this good country is that people are not usually holding back. So please, if I've said a lot of things in the last few days and spoken about a number of different practices and principles, so please do ask what you would like. Yeah, there's one back there.
Yes, yeah.
Personally, I don't see them as contradictions. But as I've been saying, those things that you're describing, that sense of ownership is a convenient fiction. And so even, so like an object, so like, you know, these are my robes. Well, a year ago, these weren't my robes. These were pieces of cloth or cotton being grown in Thailand that then got woven into cloth, and then a monk sewed them together and said, "Here, Ajahn, I'd like to give you a new robe." So now it's called my robe. It'll be my robe, and that'll have that conventional designation till it gets a few holes and have to repair it, and a few more holes and have to repair it again, until finally it's not usable anymore, and then it won't be my robe anymore. It'll be some foot wiping cloths or something. So that in this respect, you know, material objects, we can see that there's conventional designations. This is my car until somebody steals it, you know. Or, you know, this is my pen until I lose it. You know, that those those are more easy to see. You sign a set of documents. You say, "This is my apartment." But that's a human agreement, yeah, between people. It's not really yours. Yeah, if there's an earthquake and suddenly you come back and there's a big hole in the ground, yeah, that was my apartment. Not anymore. So, but when it comes to internal things, that particularly like memories or thoughts, then, as you say, they're very personal. No one has ever thought that before, or no one knows that memory because you were the only person there when that thing happened. But then, what I've been talking about is, okay, there's that feeling of ownership, but look and see if you can find what does the owning. What's that me that is the owner? What's that? Right? So you turn the attention off the object onto the subject. Okay, this is my thought. Yeah, no one's ever thought this before. This is a unique memory. No one else was there when that event happened. Yeah, I remember it. Well then, okay, what's this I that's doing the remembering? What's this I that is the owner? And that's what this kind of practice about investigation of the feeling of I and me and mine is about, when you ask those kind of questions. You know, who is it that owns this moment? Who is it that understands these words? What is it that's aware of that understanding? And then, as I was saying, you know, the more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. You know, the harder you look to try and find that sort of thing that's doing the owning, the more it opens up, and there's a realization, oh, that's a convenient way of speaking. But when you look for the thing that is the owner, nothing can be found. But again, it's important to understand the Buddha's teaching on anatta is not a kind of philosophical belief, like I believe there is no self, but more it's a suggestion, or it's a way of looking and exploring those feelings of I and me and mine. So it's a suggestion that look at, and see, can you find an owner? Can you, if there is an owner, what does it look like? Is that which knows femininity female? Is that which knows humanity human? All of the conventional attributes of being a woman, being a man, being a person, let alone having a nationality or an ID number, they, as they're looked at and explored, they fall away. And so that's why that teaching to Bahia was very, very profound. You know, in the seen, there's only the seen, in the heard, there's only the heard, and so on. So what I would encourage is, you know, when there's a looking at a thought or a memory, to explore that kind of a question. What is it that owns this? If this is mine, what is it that's doing the owning? How can any thing be owned? And then if you really explore it and go into it deeply, you begin to find that, well, even the word thing is a convenient fiction. You know, certain patterns of consciousness come together and we say, that's my memory. But it's a particular bracket or sort of collection of perceptions and sensations. We say, that's my memory of my grandmother's garden, or a memory of a conversation, but it's pieced together, it's formed. So even a thing like a bell, it's more, it's in a way, as it does in some languages, there are some languages that you can't say a bell, but you'd say, there is belling. It's that you have verbs rather than nouns, and adverbs rather than pronouns. Like, there is belling. There is beautiful belling. Yeah, but it's rather than a thing, which is a solid, separate, independent object. There's a set of events that we call bell. The elements have come together, and at the moment there is belling, but then after a time it'll dissolve and turn into something else. So there's the word sankhara in Pali is probably the best. The English word thing is probably the best translation for that. It has a very, very broad range of meanings. So the Buddha said, sabbe sankhara anicca, all things are impermanent. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all things are unsatisfactory. Because as soon as we try to hold on to a thing, there's disappointment. Because if it's pleasant, we can't keep it. If it's, you know, and if it's painful, it's uncomfortable in its presence. So so even the word thing is a convenient fiction. So this can feel like we're being left out in the middle of the traffic with no security, but this is why we also talk about the three refuges. They are the secure ground is the quality of awareness, the Buddha mind, that quality of knowing. That's a refuge, because even though the objects might be, you know, empty and transient and no, there is no thing there, the awareness, the knowing, is the ground, is the reality, that there is knowing. So that when we use the word refuge, then it's accurate. It's saying you're not just being left out in the middle of the traffic. And it's the security is there is the quality of knowing. There is the reality of the way things are. There is the Dharma, the nature, fundamental nature of things. So these are what provide the quality of stability. They give us the real ground, the real refuge. They don't give us it, they are it, I would say. Yes, I see a hand back there. Yes. Well, that the question was: can you address finding refuge when you're in the grip of anger? Well, there's a section of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. The key discourse about mindfulness development is called the Satipatthana Sutta, the Foundations of Mindfulness. And the third section of that is on Cittanupassana, or mindfulness of moods or mind states. And in that, the Buddha says, knowing the angry mind is angry, and the mind free from anger is free from anger. Yeah. The expanded mind is expanded, and the contracted mind is contracted. The agitated mind is agitated, or the unagitated mind is unagitated. And he speaks of it in terms of establishing sufficient mindfulness simply to know there is this. And that simple quality of awareness is what will, you know, is able to really liberate the heart. So that when there's an angry mood, that if we develop this, then there can be the knowing. This is the feeling of anger, and that which knows the anger is not angry. If the attention is absorbed in that, and has identified with it, then I am angry. That's the delusion of that moment. But if there's that kind of mindfulness present, then even when that feeling is very, very strong, then there can be that awareness, oh, this is a really angry feeling. And this is what it feels like. So that you're not suppressing the anger or creating self-hatred because of it, but you're also not acting on it. So there's a knowing of that wave of feeling, whoomph, you know, it wells into being. But we also, the more that mindfulness is developed, and it's a mindfulness which is holistic and informed, then the more that you're going to be able to recognize, well, that's a strong one. And it doesn't mean, being mindful of it doesn't mean not acting on it, or just trying to be passive or just freeze ourselves. It means, woof, that's a powerful feeling. Okay, that's present. Now, what's going to be the best way of handling this feeling and also working with this situation that just triggered that emotion? So just to speak a little bit about how to do this, it's rather like if you were in the Israeli army, I'm just guessing, that there were probably times when you did exercises, like military exercises, when you use weapons. And their weapons, some exercises are done with blanks, and some exercises are done with real bullets. I was never in the English army. I was actually given a dishonorable discharge from the school army cadet force. I'm quite proud of. Yeah. I was chucked out of the cadet force. But I won't go into that. But if you only try and learn when you're using live bullets, then it's very dangerous. And so it's more helpful to do your exercises with blanks. So in the meditation, we can say there's some particular event in your past that triggers a lot of anger and rage. Something or a situation that is something that you're dealing with, you know, in the current times. So if you want to learn how to develop mindfulness around the anger, then when you're in the privacy of your own home, you know, there's the other people or person is not around, then when the mind is quite focused and steady, then you can consciously bring to mind that person, just to say their name to yourself. And often, you know the story already. So I was saying to, I think with the, when we had the teacher meeting at the Bhavana House the other day, how back in the era of Margaret Thatcher, she was a very, very unpopular prime minister, at least the people who went along to Buddhist retreats. She's extremely unpopular prime minister. And so oftentimes all you had to suggest was just think the word her. And that said everything, you know. You didn't even have to say Maggie, you know, just like, that woman, you know. And it was guaranteed to trigger a reaction. So you just, without reiterating a whole story, just consciously launch the memory or the idea of that person or that event. So the point is not to analyze the story, but the point of this exercise is to look at the mechanism of the feeling. So after you've focused the mind and then deliberately brought that event or person into consciousness, then, and this is where it's the most difficult part of it, then you have to withdraw your attention from the story and the memories and the mental creation and bring it into the feeling in the body. So if you feel rage, where is it? Is it like a knife in your gut? Is it like a kind of a bar across your shoulders? Is it a tightness in your throat? Yeah. What is it? Where is it? Is it like a vibration all over, or how do we feel it? And it's going to be different for everybody. So once the feeling has been triggered, then consciously bring your attention just to the feeling. And this is where it takes the most effort, just to stay with the physical sensation of it. You're not trying to get rid of it. You're not trying to be telling a story about it. It's just, here it is. This is what rage feels like. It's this sensation here. And as I was saying at the beginning of the retreat about radical acceptance, it's important at that time to develop this quality of metta, of loving kindness and acceptance for that sensation. Because even if you can't accept what that person did and why they did it and what you're going to do next, and that might all be difficult and unbearable and complicated, the feeling is very simple. It's direct. It's almost like a kind of monosyllabic language. It's very basic, like this. Yeah, ow. And one of the interesting things is that even though we might experience emotions as very intense or difficult, we spend a lot of time and effort and money to get away from certain emotions, when we let ourselves feel them, they're not actually that bad. They're not that uncomfortable. Maybe a pressure in our chest or a tightness in the gut or this sort of steel bar across your shoulders. It's, you know, like sitting in a dentist chair. It's not fun. But it's not even as bad as a toothache or a broken leg. There's discomfort, but it's quite bearable. It's not searing, unbearable pain. So to then stay with that feeling in as direct and open a way as possible, to accept the sensation that's there, and then just consciously stay with that. Let it be there for, say, 5 or 10 minutes. And then after that time, to begin to deliberately let it go, and particularly using the rhythm of the breathing and the out-breath, the natural qualities of relaxing and relinquishing in the out-breath, to allow that feeling to slowly dissolve and wash away. So then, if the emotion is particularly strong, then it might take 5 seconds to trigger it, and then an hour for it to fade. Yeah, but that's fine. It's important, if you do this kind of practice, to stay with it until it's faded on its own. So that rather than, oh, this is getting exhausting, I've had enough of this, to just stay with it until it's sort of done its thing, and the body is relaxed again, and the feeling that's the partner of the emotion has faded from the system, faded from the body. So then at the end of that whole cycle, then the mind is back in a sense where you started from, with the attention focused in the present moment, the mind is clear and still open as possible. So in that, you've been with that whole cycle of the angry, the feeling, the rage being launched while it's been present. It's done its thing, it's lived its life, and then it's faded away. And while it's been there, while it's been alive, there has been to some degree the quality of acceptance of it. And not approving of it, but accepting it. Here it is. This is the rage reaction. So this is like what I mean by using blanks. You know, they are not in the room. You are just by yourself. That they are not here. You don't have to come up with a thing to say or do. It's just you've got space, you've got time, you've got support for letting this whole cycle go through. So then, when you follow that through, then what you find is that by learning to relate to the emotion from the physical side, then you're enabling yourself to know it as a changing experience, rather than being fixated on the object, the thing that's caused the anger. You're able to look at the process of angering, how that works. So when you do this a few times and on a regular basis, then when you're next back face-to-face with that person, or they give you a call, or you have to work with them, and then, whoomph, that feeling gets triggered, then maybe part of your attention is going out to the conversation, but then part of you is able to stay with the physical feel. Oh, it's that reaction again. I know this. It's just this flow of sensation through the system. Don't panic. Don't get caught up. It's just this. And there's a bit more space that we find we have available to us, so that we're not caught in that anger reaction, but we're able to receive what the other person is saying or doing, and then rather than reacting compulsively to that in a blind way, that little bit of extra space, of since we know that reactive process, then that helps us to be able to respond to the situation rather than be pulled in. So I've used this a lot in the past, with more with fear than with anger. I'm more of a fear type than an anger type. So that's more what I've used it with, but I find it extraordinarily effective. And but it takes work, because the habits that we have are usually very, very strong. Yeah, there's a question down here. You had something. Yeah, you can ask it out loud so people can hear.
Take it, because I don't remember. How the understanding of dukkha, anicca, and anatta can be experienced at the level of the heart as a bhavanamayapanya, and not only as a reflection during meditation, which is more intellectual?
If you could say it louder.
Yes. How the understanding of dukkha, anicca, and anatta can be experienced at the level of the heart as a bhavanamayapanya, and not only as a repeating reflection during meditation, which is more intellectual. Like sometimes I feel that it's something that I really understand, but the conscious mind understands it, but it's like a borrowed panya. It's not really like the non-self, for example, when there are pains, so I work with it a little bit, but it's difficult for me to understand this is not my pain, and just to understand, okay, there is pain, without
identifying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think okay. So it's about experience of anicca, dukkha, anatta as a felt experience in the heart, rather than just an intellectual application. So that's it's something I've been talking about a bit. You know, during these days, that that we just use the words to help the attention to be brought to those qualities, so in that In that same way, that if we want to explore, say, anicca, the quality of change, and then, but we can also use a thought or an idea to lead us into that. Say, well, what does change feel like? What is the feeling of change in a wordless way? What do I feel right now that's changing? What is that? How does that changingness feel? So you're leading the attention in to explore things in that way, and then consciously leaving the words aside. Yeah. If dukkha is usually very accessible, you know, knee pain or pain in your back, and again, just to lead the mind in with a question or a suggestion of, let's see if this ache in my left hip joint can be known just as dukkha. What is this feeling as it is? What is that? How is this? So you lead the attention to that experience using a reflection or a thought, but then you leave the thought at the door. So leave that behind and let the attention just rest at the experience itself. And so that's how I would use that in that way. If we've got an overactive thinking mind, that's always ready to comment on everything, then it's difficult to even find a short break in the word stream, right? Yeah, and I speak from direct experience. That's when I first came into the monastery, the concept of stopping thinking was really inconceivable. You know, it seemed like I was at least thinking three or four things at once, all the time. And so so we can use different ways to help interrupt the stream of thoughts. And even just ways of highlighting what's going on, like the thinking mind, like just to be able to reflect, here is the thinking mind, it's got something to say about everything. And when you bring that to mind, for a moment it'll stop. Like, what do you mean? How dare you? And so we almost have to trick ourselves into thoughtlessness. But if we're patient, and if we explore, we realize there's a lot of experiences that we have that are wordless already. Like music. Like if you're listening to a piece of music, like a piece of Israeli music or classical music or modern music, particularly if it's just instrumental, it's a language, but it's a wordless language, right? And so, I've done that. I very rarely listen to music. It's part of our rules is not to. So, but once in a while, you do hear some music, and it's really extraordinary because you're listening to, say, Beethoven's Pastoralia, the Pastoral Symphony, and you realize this is a language that has no words. Here's a story being told, and you can just be with that story and the feeling of it and the presence of it, but it's not built around thinking. Or your mind can go, oh, here comes the stormy bit, the thunder's about to happen. But that's the thinking mind kind of jumping in. But if you just let yourself listen, right there you have the experience of feeling and emotion and watching change in particular. As music is constantly changing, the sound is in incessant flow, but because it's got a variety of objects, lots of notes and melodies and forms, but they're non-verbal, they're non-conceptual. Unless if you're a musicologist, then it doesn't work, or that you think, oh, that's where the B flat goes to the C minor. So it's best if you don't know anything about music. But I find that that's a really interesting or useful area to use, where you can attend to the quality of flow or change, and then and not be creating a commentary about it, to leave the thinking I mean, it's particularly acute because I very, very rarely listen to music. So hearing music is such an odd thing. So my mind doesn't just hear music and carry on thinking. It's because it so rarely hears music that it's a sort of novel experience. So it gets really interested in it. But if you're hearing music all the time, then it's easy just to put the music into the background. But also you can use the physical sensations of the body. So using like a body sweeping, again, without doing too much naming of like, oh, here is my left shoulder, you know, here's my right shoulder, here's my left shoulder, but just bringing the attention piece by piece through the body, because all the sensations through the body are different. Like in your face, or your shoulders, your hands, they're not the same. So in a way, it's like listening to music too. There's a whole variety of sensations and qualities that are there. But it's non-verbal, it's non-conceptual. And so but you're moving, you're creating variety through moving through the body. So you're using that non-repetitive quality. So you're using that quality of variety to help sustain interest. But what you're noticing is change itself. Maybe this one over here, yeah. Don't take it personally. Just trying to vary from side to side, you know. Fair dues, yeah, okay.
So I probably want to ask about the different things. About bringing the attention. Now, I, as a person, whoever I am, has a problem of bringing my attention to those things. It's called in the New Age language, ADHD. So, when I take medication, it's very easy for me to do what everybody else does. But I don't think it can be very frustrating or very hard. So, does Buddha has a section for ADHD?
I would just keep taking the medication.
This was a continuous question, actually, because I actually don't know if I should handle it like this, or should I do it in an easy way?
Well, it's a good question. It's not uncommon. And it's not exactly the same, but one Buddhist term that relates to ADHD, attention deficit disorder, is udacha kukucha. Perfect. Yeah, it even sounds that way, doesn't it? Yeah. You feel sort of fidgety and itchy just hearing it. Yeah. Udacha kukucha, which means restlessness and worry or agitation. So the mind's habit of constantly chasing after one thing or another, and so the ways of dealing with that kind of restlessness is primarily it's through a lot of body awareness. Oftentimes, when we get very focused on the mental world, we don't notice how much the body is affecting the mind, but the body and the mind affect each other all the time. And so one of the best ways of one of the things the Buddha recommends in terms of dealing with restlessness is what they call calming the bodily formation, or the relaxing the body. And so that kind of body sweeping meditation, you know, spending quite a bit of time, like at the beginning of any meditation period, if it's like, say, a 45-minute period, spend at least the first 15 or 20 minutes just slowly going through the body piece by piece, noticing wherever there is tension, like around your eyes, in your jaw, in your lips, you know, your neck, you know, piece by piece, just slowly working through the body, you know, your shoulders, your neck, and then with each area, noticing the tension that's there and consciously relaxing, inviting the body to settle and be free of tension. So the piece by piece, you know, slowly go through the whole of the body, and wherever you find the tension or tightness, to consciously relax that. And then when you get down to your feet, then come back through and you realize, oh, while you're busy relaxing your knees, then your shoulders have tightened up again. You're relaxing your face and your belly is knotted up. So in this way, you're sort of developing a feeling for the sensations of the body, and then going back, you know, back up and down through the body, as I say, about 15-20 minutes, till the body is really, really settled and free of tension, and then start to work on the mental level, and that has a big effect, you know, that one of the things I was being told by a doctor many years ago, and other people have told me it's not entirely accurate, but it's to a degree, is that Valium, which is a tranquilizer, you know, which is a is more of a muscle relaxant. It works more on your muscles than it does on your brain. And that, you know, it's like you can do a little experiment now. Okay, so no. I'm not going to pass out Valium, but just so if we, it's not within my remit or my wish. So if you tighten your stomach, like tense up your belly right now, right, you feel anxious. Right, I'm not reading minds. It's just how we work. You know, you tighten your stomach. I instantly start to feel worried, and then we relax. Let your stomach spread. This is the abs of jello rather than abs of steel. You know, just let your stomach spill over your waistband. And then, how does it feel? Oh, life is a bit more easy. So just like a tiny little exercise like that, what did that take, 15 seconds? So right here you can see that the way we hold the body has a direct effect on the mind. You tense the body up and then you feel worried. You relax the body and then the mind feels more at ease. So in terms of that agitation and restlessness of attention, it's not going to have a totally curative effect, but that at least steers things in a good way. But also, I wasn't entirely joking about the medication. That sometimes if things are out of balance within us, just like if you've got diabetes, take the insulin. there's ways we can handle it with diet and living skillfully, but it is really handy to have insulin, you know, if you're diabetic. And it's not a weakness to take medicine if the body's got an imbalance of too much of this or not enough of that, that, you know, that's common sense rather than a weakness. And so there are certain things that meditation can be a benefit for and can help with, and certain things is beyond the scope. And so the Buddha had a doctor. Jivaka was the Buddha's doctor. He had all kinds of different treatments. He was a totally enlightened, self-enlightened Buddha, and he was still quite happy to have the doctor come and see him from time to time. So if you need the medicine and it really helps, then don't be afraid. I would say, in my humble opinion, my not very humble opinion, don't be afraid to take the medicine if it helps. Yeah, at the back, you're being patient there. Yeah, the guy with the red blanket.
We read today in the chanting the last verse, when they act upon intention, all beings are the owners of their action. And I wanted to ask about if you can shed a light on this idea of karma and intention. When the gentleman asked before about anger, and you gave an example of using intention internally, kind bullets, does that not affect karma in any way? I don't understand exactly this concept of karma and how it is related to intentional action, and also non-intentional. I mean, people do things non-intentionally, and it does affect the world very much. Mm-hmm. It probably, you know, comes back at things. So you can elucidate that.
Well, it's a good question. Also, I should preface what I say by the Buddha listed four imponderable things, or things that are beyond the realm of conception, and one of them was all of the workings of karma. So, So, but I'll do my best just to sort of say a few things. There is also a statement of the Buddha where he says karma is intention. That what we mean by karma, action, karma is intention. And so that, and he made a strong distinction within his teaching, as a contrast to several of the other teachings of his time, where they said that whether you tread on an ant by accident, you didn't even see it was there, or you tread on an ant on purpose, the karmic result is the same. And the Buddha said, no, intention makes a huge difference. If you see an ant and you deliberately kill it, there's a different effect on, there's the same effect on the ant, but it's a different effect on you, whether you did it intentionally or not. And also the laws of most countries reflect that. There's common sense and law, structures of law in most countries reflect that as well. So that, the translation there in the teachings about the Brahma Viharas, that was trying to, it doesn't actually say that in such detail in the Pali, but the person who translated it was trying to emphasize that it's not just action that we take, but intentional action that is the thing that it makes the most difference. So of course, people do things unintentionally that cause harm, also cause benefit to others. And so that there is that those effects are felt. Also, there's a very blurry area, the whole, the devil made me do it. It wasn't really me, it was just my desire that took over. Or as George Harrison put it, it's only me, it's not my mind. That we can kind of split things apart in clumsy or confusing ways. The more that we develop mindfulness and look at our actions and our words, the more we can, in a way, see for ourselves, rather than blaming the devil that made me do something bad, or that something beneficial has come from the gods. To instead see things much more in terms of cause and effect, which is what the Buddha was encouraging. That seeing how karma and its result, which is, so the technical term for karma and its result is kamma vipaka, so action and its result. You see, he tried to put things across in terms of seeing it as cause and effect, the laws of nature. So if we act in a kindly way, if we act in an honest way, if we benefit in a way that benefits others, then we feel good. And other people feel good too, broadly speaking. And if we act in a way that's selfish and cruel, and then that's going to be painful for others, and it's also going to have painful results for ourselves in the broadest possible way. But he also pointed out that there's two interesting, very interesting, significant teachings together, side by side, in the middle-length discourses. One, the lesser and the greater discourses on karma, the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutta and the Maha Kama Vibhanga Sutta. So they sit side by side in the book, and one of them says, if you are virtuous, if you keep all the precepts, then in your next life you'll be born with a beautiful complexion and you'll be very attractive. If you are stingy and selfish in this life, then in the next life you'll be born sort of ugly and misshapen. Because of this, therefore that. And it goes through a whole list of this is the cause, that's the effect. And in quite a almost mechanistic way. And in the next sutta, what he says is that, and people, it starts off by someone saying, well, how come, this guy, he's really selfish, he's cruel, he's greedy, he's hurtful to other people. How come he's got a huge house, a big yacht, five girlfriends, and a gigantic bank account, and he seems to be having a grand old time, that's not fair. And this other person, you know, she's a really sweet character. She's very kind, generous, and she's got this horrible disease. She's never hurt anybody. You know, how come something, you know, this, how come she's getting this bad deal? So that question was being asked 2,500 years ago, just as it is today. And then the Buddha points out that it's true, cause and effect match each other, but exactly how and when and where the karma will ripen is completely unpredictable. So that yes, because of this cause, there'll be that effect, but exactly how and where and in what form, it's impossible to say. So that I feel it's very skillful having those two side by side. And so we can see that the laws of cause and effect do work, but we also see that life is indeed very, very complicated. And there's an awful lot of variables in this equation. And so exactly how things ripen and work out is not predictable. And so that's a not incredibly short response to your question, but I feel it's also important to it's a thing to reflect upon and look at how things that we've done in our lives that may be hurtful to others, and if we look and see, well, yes, I really was doing that deliberately, and how that feels now, and when we did something that was an accident or was just our own carelessness. And we look at that, and and then to me, and I look at my own life, they're held in very different ways. I can see you've got a follow-up coming. Yeah.
The question, what you took it, you explained a lot about action.
Uh-huh.
And how it relates to karma. And my question was more about intention.
Uh-huh.
How does intention, when you don't act, you just have an intention.
Oh, I see. So, excuse me, I didn't understand that. Sorry.
Something in the world. And when I say karma, I just don't mean direct cause and effect, but that it does affect the world in some way.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you just practice on anger inside you, does that have some kind of an effect outside of you? When we have an intention for whatever, you know, good or bad, how does that affect?
Yeah, I would say the way we work with our mind, either immediately or long term, that it has an effect. It might be not visible, but experience shows that if I'm sitting here generating loving kindness, that there's going to be certain signals that are put out just by the expression on my face or the posture of my body or the general feeling that is around. And if I'm here generating resentment and anger, and then there's going to be a different set of body language. There's going to be a different facial expression. There's going to be a different hormonal process going on. And so that I'm not the having an intention that is not acted on, even internally, I would say, doesn't have a big effect. If you're acting on something to like consciously generate loving kindness within yourself, I'd say that's an action. It's not speech, or it's a mental action. It's not done in the form of language or external activity, but it's a thing that is being done, just like developing concentration or wisdom. So, but just an intention that's not being acted upon, I say those are very flimsy and slight, and so that within the Buddha's teaching, he points out that those don't have they don't carry any weight, they don't carry any strength. And within our monastic rule, we have very, very closely defined rules, and so if you simply have an impulse, like if you feel sexually attracted towards someone, or you feel irritated by someone, you might feel an impulse to hit somebody, or you might feel an impulse to go and get close to somebody. But if that just passes through and that's not acted upon, there's no offense. Yeah, for a monk or a nun, it's like there's no offense there. It's a wrongdoing if you pursue it, if you act on it or speak on it. But if it's just an internal, a wave of feeling, an intention that's not even acted on internally, then it carries no weight. It's like smoke in the wind. That's how it's expressed in the teaching. So I see we've already gone past to our 5:15 point, and I've speaking of karma, I made an undertaking to spend time with some of the cooks at 5:15, so without intention, I've overstepped the mark there, so we'll bring this conversation to a close, and please carry on with the next period of walking meditation.